Hello, and thank you for joining us for this episode of the Nation of Writers podcast. This podcast is presented in conjunction with our new virtual exhibit, American Voices, which you can explore at nationofwriters.org. That's nationofwriters.org.
Hello, and thank you for tuning into Nation of Writers, where we explore our country's literary history by examining significant American voices. Today, we will learn more about author, educator, and activist Margaret Walker. My name is Christina Carrera, guest and services and operations supervisor for the American Writers Museum in Chicago. Joining me from Mississippi today is Angela Stewart, archivist at the Margaret Walker Center. Angela, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Christina, for having me. I've been looking forward to this.
Yes, definitely. Mm-hmm. Well, to start off with, tell us a little bit about the Margaret Walker Center and your role in the museum.
Okay. Well, we were founded in 1968 as the Institute for the Study of the History, Life, and Culture of Black People. We were founded as a Black Studies Institute by Margaret Walker, or as she was known around Jackson and Jackson State, Dr. Margaret Walker Alexander. And on Jackson State's campus, it was primarily at that time a public programming arm of Jackson State, as well as it monitored the offerings in terms of Black history and Black-related courses such as Black sociology, history of Black music that were offered on campus at Jackson State, because Jackson State, we still don't have a formal Black studies program, but the Institute was founded to promote the study of Black history and culture on campus and to provide programming for such. So we were founded in 1968. In 1971, we hosted the National Evaluative Conference on Black Studies, which looked at the brand new discipline of Black studies and brought in scholars from throughout the United States, such as John Heinrich Clark and Andrew Billingsley and Harry Edwards and just a wide array of African-American scholars and activists and writers to talk about the new discipline of Black studies. In 1973, and you can see this image here, 1973 marked the 200th anniversary of the publication of Phyllis Wheatley's first book of poetry. And what you can see in this image is a bust of Phyllis Wheatley that was done by Elizabeth Catlett, who had been a classmate of Margaret Walker's at the University of Iowa. And Margaret Walker actually reached out to her the summer of 1973 and said, "We're having this conference honoring Phyllis Wheatley. We would love to have a bust of her. And can you have it ready by November?" And it arrived November 1st on campus, a bronze cast bust of Phyllis Wheatley by Elizabeth Catlett. And that conference was significant in that it brought around 23 well-known African-American women poets to the campus, mm-hmm. people such as Alice Walker and Sonia Sanchez and Nikki Giovanni and Mari Evans and Margaret Danner and Margaret Burroughs and others to campus to talk about what it meant to be a Black woman, a writer, especially during the Black Arts Movement, which was the movement in terms of literary movements at that point in time. And just in the post-Civil Rights era, and the women's movement era, what it meant to be a woman writer. And it was a wonderful conference. So that's one of the things we did. So from 1968 to 1979, Margaret Walker served as the director of the Institute for the Study of the History, Life, and Culture of Black People. In 1979, she retired from Jackson State. And the Institute was renamed, and wait for this, the Margaret Walker Alexander National Research Center for the Study of the 20th Century African American. That's a lot of names. And we recently rebranded and shortened it to the Margaret Walker Center. And the reason for that is more people know her as Margaret Walker because that's the name she wrote under. That was her pen name. But at Jackson State, she was a very proud wife and mother and academician. So at Jackson State, she was more commonly known as Dr. Margaret Walker Alexander, which is why that name was attached initially to the center. Since 1979, we have focused on three main areas. Archives, we have over 40 paper-based manuscript collections. Margaret Walker's papers are the largest, one of the largest collections we have. We do also have collections such as Dr. Roderick R. Page, who is the first African-American to serve as United States Secretary of Education, and other collections that range from one item to over 100 linear feet in size. We also have an extensive oral history collection. We have over 2,000 oral histories, which range in media from reel to born digital. So, and oral histories are something we are still actively doing today. Our second director, after Margaret Walker retired, Dr. Albertine Harrison, became our second director, and she instituted the oral history program and actually collected most of our initial oral histories. And we also have an extensive art collection and material culture collection. One of the things that Dr. Albertine Harrison also was very passionate about was collecting material culture from African-American communities. Because she said she always wanted her children to be able to hold and see representations of African-American history and culture. So that's something else we have as well. In addition to the Margaret Walker Center, which is located in Air Hall, which is the oldest building on the campus of Jackson State University, we also manage the COFO Center. COFO stands for the Council of Federated Organizations. It was founded to coordinate the work of four main civil rights groups in Mississippi: the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and the Congress of Racial Equality. And it operated in Jackson from the early to mid-60s to about 1966. And it was the epicenter of what became known as Freedom Summer in Mississippi. That's where Bob Moses and David Dennis directed over 800 volunteers who came to Mississippi the summer of 1964 to register people to vote, to teach people how to read and write, to introduce children to literature, science, as well as theater. So these are the kinds of things that were going on at the COFO Center. And it's now a wonderful museum, as well as a powerful place because, you know, Martin Luther King and others actually spent time in that actual building. So that's something else we manage as well.
That's amazing. For sure. Going back into Margaret Walker's life back in history, Margaret Walker's father, who immigrated from Jamaica, was a scholar and a minister, her mother a music teacher. Early on, her parents moved the family to New Orleans. Can you tell us about how this early upbringing and environment contributed to her becoming a writer?
Sure. As you mentioned, Margaret Walker's father was a Jamaican immigrant who came to the United States to attend Northwestern University, where he received his master's of theology degree. He was a teaching preacher after he married Marion Dozier. And I have, you can see these images. This is actually her dad, Sigismund Walker, and her mom is on the far end on this image. This is her band, Marion Dozier Walker. But he was a teaching preacher who initially was teaching in Birmingham, Alabama, which is where Margaret Walker was born, July 7th, 1915. The family briefly moved to Meridian, Mississippi, where he taught at Haven Institute. And then from there, they moved to New Orleans, where she grew up from the time she was about 10 years old until she graduated high school on the campus of what is now called Dillard University. And that exposure, being there on that campus, it allowed her to meet people such as Langston Hughes and other people who had come through, because people like Langston Hughes and Marian Anderson and others, the way they were able to get out and share their gifts was by touring places such as historically Black colleges and universities, as well as churches and things. So, and her parents were very driven and determined about what they wanted for their children. You know, Margaret Walker makes the point that when she initially told her dad when she was about 12 or 13 that she wanted to write, he was like, oh, it's a phase she's going through. But he gave her a blank diary and challenged her to write something in it every day. And so for 365 days, she wrote a piece, either original piece, or she transcribed poets that she enjoyed, such as Paul Laurence Dunbar. And at the end of the year, her dad says, well, maybe it's not a phase after all. This might be something she's serious about. And when they realized that, they encouraged and supported her in that. Langston Hughes, who had been challenged by Mary McLeod Bethune to do a series of what he called Southern poetry tours and lectures, came to Dillard University when Margaret Walker was about 14. And she had her little leaflet of poetry, and she was debating whether to share it with him or not. And her mom just finally made her, you're here now, he's here, go ahead. And, you know, she kind of pushed her into, and he was blown away by her gift already as a 14-year-old. And he helped her to get published in journals such as the Crisis Journal. And they became lifelong friends and mentor and protege. So that was, you know, her childhood. She had the opportunity, you know, growing up on a university campus where they're bringing in, you know, guest speakers and authors and singers and things like that. And as you can see from this picture, her mom was a musician and a band director. So she had all of that. And actually her sister, her younger sister, was an aspiring concert pianist. So just surrounded by talent all the way around.
Such a prominent writer as a mentor early on.
Yes.
Great experience. And so, yeah, so she moved on then in her father's footsteps. To say Margaret Walker moved to Chicago and attended Northwestern University. She became part of the Chicago Black Renaissance Movement with the Southside Writers Group. Can you tell us about this experience in her life and the connections she made?
Yes. Actually, Langston Hughes, in reading and corresponding with her, encouraged her to leave the South for her bachelor's degree. That was something he encouraged her to do. And Northwestern University was someplace she knew about because that's where her dad went to school. Sure. So actually, she and her younger sister, Mercedes, entered Northwestern University. Her dad and mom took her to Evanston, Illinois, and enrolled her at Northwestern University, which had a very excellent English department in terms of creative writing. She came to Northwestern with 300 pages of Jubilee already sketched out. So she was already writing, and she had people like Dr. Hungerford who encouraged and challenged her in her writing at Northwestern. So she was very trained and excited and exposed about writing when she graduated from Northwestern. And it just so happened that at the time she graduated, the Federal Writers Project was going on in Chicago. And that provided her the opportunity to work with writers such as Richard Wright, and Frank Yerby and Studs Terkel and other writers in Chicago, both of the Chicago Renaissance, but just Chicago writers in general, people who were writing, artists such as Studs Terkel, who were writing in Chicago at that time period in the 1930s. She became quickly, for example, Richard Wright recognized her talent very quickly, and he brought her on to be his research associate. When he was working on his novel, Native Son, she did a lot of the background research for that novel. When he decided to move on from Chicago to New York City, she took over his Southside Writers Project. And she became director of that until she, as you said, the government decided it was time to stop supporting writers and other groups like that. And they ended the Federal Writers Project. And from there, she went back to school. She went to the State University of Iowa in Iowa City in what was a relatively new program they had called the Writers Workshop. It's still one of the most well-respected creative writing programs in the United States today. And that's where she received her master's degree. And instead of doing a traditional master's thesis, she completed her first book of poetry. She had initially published For My People in 1937 in the journal Poetry. And that was also a goal of hers as a young girl. She wanted to be published in a well-respected journal like Poetry. And in 1937, she was able to publish For My People. While at the State University of Iowa, she expanded For My People into a collection of poems that include both revolutionary type poems, such as For My People itself, but also folk poetry. Someone she had gotten to know well while in Chicago was Sterling A. Brown, who was a expert on Negro folklore, as they called it at that time. And so she invested a lot into writing what you would call Negro folk poems, African-American folk poems. And also, I think it was a influence of her grandmother, who she grew up with in her home, who had been a slave in Georgia and had spent part of her childhood in Alabama. And so I think she also got these stories such as Stagger Lee and others from her grandmother as well. But that was her first book of poetry. Now, when she completed the writer's program for her master's, she had been applying several times to the Yale Younger Poets Awards, and she had been turned down at least twice for that. But in 1942, she was awarded the Yale Younger Poets Award, and that's what allowed her to publish her first book of poetry. Yale University Press published For My People, and her foreword was written by Stephen Vincent Benet, who was actually one of the people responsible for helping her get the Yale Younger Poet Award. He kept encouraging her despite, you know, her previous rejections to keep on trying for the award, and she was awarded it in 1942.
And yeah, For My People really launched her career as a writer. And her title poem, which is often, it's recited, there's a power of resilience in the community and hope for a stronger future. And what way do you feel this book wants to speak to us?
You know, Margaret Walker, if you read each stanza of For My People, she takes us through African-American history, culture, and life from our beginnings in America as enslaved individuals all the way down to, you know, let a new earth rise, the idea of making a new earth for everyone, for, as she says, for all the Adams and Eves and their countless generation. Now, as the archivist at the Margaret Walker Center, I have to tell you, I have had people from as far away as Beijing, China, who've contacted me about for information about For My People, who've been inspired by For My People. So the poem has a reach to a large group of people who consider themselves maybe marginalized, or who are looking to improve their lives in, or looking for motivation. So I think that's also something that comes out of that poem, For My People.
Sure. And I also love the folkloric elements and the memorable characters that fill her poems. One of my favorite poems is Molly Means, about a New Orleans sorceress. Do you have a favorite poem or an aspect of Walker's writing that you would like to mention or highlight?
Yes, I actually do have a favorite poem. And it's a poem she wrote. Margaret Walker had the wonderful opportunity to get to know several writers, both people who were her mentors, people who were her peers, and people she was a mentor to. And one of her peers was Robert Hayden out of Washington, D.C. And so she wrote a poem to him called Tribute to Robert Hayden. And she said, "For this man I first read 40 years ago, quiet, respectful, loving music and religion, loving God and mankind, speaking pearls and weaving tapestries, drinking from the fountains of wisdom, truth, and beauty, teaching us divinity. I think across the years of a young man of 22, writing heart shape in the dust, years in Nashville, years eaten by the locusts, and in 1952 at Jackson State College, 75th anniversary with Langston and Arna and Owen and Melvin Tolson, Sterling and me, a happy time." And, you know, so this was a tribute she wrote to Robert Hayden that allows you to know more about both him and her. And she did that several times, you know, when there would be significant events or at the passing of friends of hers, she would write tribute poetry. And some of her tribute poetry is some of my favorite poetry that she does.
Excellent. So hearing that. So you mentioned her epic novel, Jubilee, and it was set before, during, and after the Civil War. It tells a story of the daughter of a plantation owner and a slave, her family. Can you tell us about how Walker wove her own family's history and years of research to write the accurate truth of a life of a slave on a plantation?
Okay. And as you can see here, this is actually her great-grandmother and her grandmother, who she based Jubilee on. Her grandmother, Elvira Ware Dozier, lived with Margaret Walker. She moved in right before her mother gave birth to Margaret in 1915. And she lived with Margaret Walker's family until her death. And she would always tell Margaret about what it was like being a slave in Alabama and what it was like when emancipation came and they left, a slave in Georgia and they left Georgia for Alabama. And all of those experiences, and her parents were horrified. They were like, "Why are you telling that child all those harrowing tales?" Because these were not happy stories by any stretch of the imagination. And she said, "I'm not telling her stories, I'm telling her the truth." And it always impacted Margaret that she wanted her grandmother's story to be validated. So from a young girl, she spent time researching. As I mentioned, she had about 300 pages of Jubilee already sketched out when she got to Northwestern. So she had spent a lot of time thinking about, but she researched 30 years on the story because she would write and then she put it down, but she spent time at the National Archives. She went to Georgia and actually found her great-grandfather's he was a blacksmith, his blacksmith shop, Randall Ware's blacksmith shop. So she was able to do the research in finding out about her grandmother and her great-grandmother. And this is an image of Margaret Duggins Ware Brown, who is her great-grandmother. That's the woman in the black outfit. And then her grandmother, Elvira Dozier, Elvira Ware Dozier. And so, but she saw in both of her great-grandmother and her grandmother a strength and a courage and a determination because of the things they made it through from slavery to freedom and came out the other side whole individuals. That was something she always admired and wanted to share. So she, like I said, she spent 30 years doing this research. She decided to go back to receive her PhD, and she went back to the State University of Iowa. And while there, she completed Jubilee. And she said it was ironic. She completed Jubilee around the same time her great-grandmother and grandmother were emancipated from slavery, like 100 years difference between they were emancipated in April 1865, and she finished Jubilee around that time period, 1965, so 100 years later. That allowed her the opportunity to share with individuals, not just her family history, because Jubilee is woven with folk history of the area. If you want to know things about, you know, Terrell County, Georgia, or about the Selma area of Alabama, there's a lot of information about that. I've been doing research on Black midwives, and she talks about midwives in there because, you know, Jubilee opens with her great-great-grandmother dying in childbirth after having been repeatedly raped by her owner, and the helplessness her midwife feels in trying to take care of her. So Jubilee actually opened the door to a new form of literature called the neo-slave narrative. You know, earlier slave narratives, you go, you know, back to Sojourner Truth and even back beyond before that to others who wrote Frederick Douglass and others, Linda Brent, others who wrote about their experiences as slaves. But the neo-slave narrative was a literary, I guess you could almost say a secondhand account of what it was like to have been a slave. And people she directly influenced in this were people like Toni Morrison, who would go on to write Beloved, Ishmael Reed and others who would write, J. California Cooper and others who would write neo-slave narratives. But one of the most important things for me in Jubilee is the discussion of what does it mean to be free? What is true freedom? And there are three main characters who discuss that from three different approaches. Viary, for her freedom is making sure her children get what she never got, which is an education. So being able to provide for her children an education and being able to keep them safe and whole, to her, that's freedom. Her first husband, her children's father, her two oldest children's father, Randall Ware, he believes politics are the key to freedom because he feels like unless the newly freed are able to control their destinies politically, they will always have the opportunity of being enslaved again. And then Viary's current husband, Ennis Brown, for him, freedom is work. It is owning your own land and working your own on your own land. You know, Jim, Viary's son and Elvira's brother, says, you know, I could have stayed a slave if I just have to work. And Ennis says, no, now you're working for yourself. you're working to build up a legacy for your family and for your future generations. And to him and to Ennis, that's what freedom was, having the opportunity to be able to leave a material legacy to his children and grandchildren and other descendants. So that, to me, is probably one of the most significant discussions in Jubilee.
Sure, no, groundbreaking work, the writing of the neo-slave narrative required other forms of writing to continue that voice, for sure. In what ways do you think this writing demonstrated her support and her commitment to activism in her novels and her poetry?
She was always about encouraging activism. It's interesting. In our collection at the Margaret Walker Center, we have letters that Richard Wright wrote to her. And he, at first, in the 1930s, she was like, am I really an activist? I write. And he said, active writers are the most important types of activists. That's because great. Writers encourage, inform, and motivate action. And that was always her goal, both as a writer, but also as a teacher, because for 30 years, she taught at Jackson State. And I can say on a personal level, because my mother was actually a student of Margaret Walker.
Oh, that's great.
Jackson State. And the woman in the white with the corsage, that's actually my mom. And you can see her looking on very proud.
Yes.
And Margaret Walker. And Margaret Walker is being pinned by Mrs. Donna Dye, who was at that time the wife of the lieutenant governor of Mississippi. And the tall gentleman looking down at Margaret Walker was her husband, Brad Dye, who at that time was the lieutenant governor of the state of Mississippi. So she taught my mother in college, and she and my mother remained close until Margaret Walker's passing. And my mother was somebody who was an activist in her community and would always credit the inspiration that Margaret Walker provided in class as one of the reasons why she was so determined to make her world a better place. And the exposure that she provided for her students. So it was even more than just her writing, which, of course, has always been an inspiration to generations of individuals, but people like my mom, who were fortunate enough to have her as a teacher.
Was she a tough teacher? Did she expect a lot from her students?
Yes. That's something else my mom always commented on. She said, You were always there, you know, just almost on pins and needles. You knew a lot was expected of you, but she also empowered them that they could do it, you know, and that they had a right to have their opinions. So, you know, it was never a dictatorship, you know, it was always a dialogue that she provided for her students. And gave them the confidence that they had a right to their voice in what they believed as well.
So, yeah, definitely. So these are the questions that I have. Is there anything else you would like to mention, Margaret Walker or the center that we have?
Yes. The Margaret Walker Center, we are located in the oldest building on the campus of Jackson State University. Jackson State University was founded in Natchez, Mississippi in 1877. The year Reconstruction ended is when Jackson State was founded. And it was founded as Natchez Seminary to train African Americans to be preachers and teachers. And the school has always been very proud of the fact that it was not a vocational training center. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but that it was a school that encouraged college preparatory and liberal arts education from its inception And it was a cooperative effort between the American Baptist Home Mission Society and a group of formerly enslaved individuals led by Henry P. Jacobs. And when the school decided to move to Jackson, after a couple of stops in other locations, it finally ended up on the Lynch Street location where it is now. And this is the first permanent building that was built on the Lynch Street campus of Jackson State University. And Lynch Street is named for John Roy Lynch, who was the first African-American to serve in the United States House of Representatives from Mississippi. He represented the 6th Congressional District. And that's who Lynch, because sometimes people, when they hear the word Lynch Street, they go, why would you name a street Lynch Street? Yeah. That is actually named for John Roy Lynch. And this was the first, and at the time, Margaret Walker was working at Jackson State. This building was primarily a dormitory as well as the student co-op building where they could, had a post office and where they could hang out and purchase hamburgers and things like that. Actually, that bottom floor, which where my office is now, was the student hangout spot when Margaret Walker was working at Jackson State. But as I mentioned earlier, we have three main focuses. We have an extensive manuscript collection. You know, HBO just premiered recently the Judas and the Black Messiah. One of our collections we have is the Frankie Adams Johnson Black Panthers Party archives papers. We have Frankie Adams Johnson became a member of the Black Panthers after graduating from Tougaloo College, which is a local African-American college, and was very active in the New York area Black Panther Party. But she also has a wonderful collection of Black Panther newspapers in their collection, a collection of Emory Douglas's sketches and artwork that he used in that. So that's part of that collection. We have Margaret Walker's papers digitized. We have about 50% of her paper collection digitized as well. We have, as I mentioned, one of my favorite collections, Amanda McAuliffe, developed a scrapbook of sayings of her grandmother, things her grandmother used to say. And it's a handmade, hand-drawn, beautiful little scrapbook of, you know, precious sayings of her grandmother. And that's probably our smallest collection, all the way to we have the Julius Thompson collection on Black Studies, which is over 100 linear feet. We also have an extensive oral history collection. We have oral histories on Head Start, the Mississippi Civil Rights Movement, the Piney Woods School, which was founded in Piney Woods, Mississippi in 1909, what life was like during segregation, the influence of the Black church on the civil rights movement, the work of women during the civil rights movement. So we have a number of oral history collections as well. We are continuing to collect oral histories. Last year, we commemorated the 50th anniversary of the murder of James Green and Philip Lafayette Gibbs on the Jackson State campus. During the same month, about 10 days after the Kent State shooting in Kent, Ohio, there was a shooting at Jackson State, and two young men lost their lives as well as 12 others were injured. And we spearhead the commemoration of that event, and we are collecting oral histories related to primarily the survivors of that event, both in terms of literal survivors. We've interviewed the widow of Philip Gibbs, who actually didn't even know at the time, but she was pregnant with her second child at the time her husband was killed. And you have to understand, her husband had a sister who was on campus, a student on campus at Jackson State, and he just stopped by to talk to her at her dorm. He was outside, and she was leaning out from her window at her dorm, and that's where he was when he was tragically shot down. James Green was a 17-year-old high school student who was working a part-time job to help support his family, who was on his way home from work. And as he frequently did, he decided to cut through campus as kind of a shortcut heading home, and he was shot and killed. And so we have interviews with his family members as well as students who were in school at Jackson State at that time and either were physically or emotionally hurt, damaged by what happened. So that's one of our current oral history collections. We are in collaboration with our former director, Dr. Alfredine Harrison, on a project called the Scott Ford House Project. Scott Ford were two homes owned by women who served as midwives in Mississippi, in Jackson. And we are collecting oral histories of people's experiences with midwives in Mississippi. So that's another one of our oral history collections. We also have museum space. So we have exhibits on Jackson State. We have exhibits on Margaret Walker. We have artwork, both from one of our former board members, Paul Campbell, as well as his students. So we have, like I said, a wide variety of collection then. And then the COFO Center, as I mentioned, is something we are managers of as well. So those are the kinds of things we do at the Margaret Walker Center. You know, the challenge has been during COVID, the campus has been basically, we're beginning to open back up in terms of the campus, but we've been basically closed. So it's been wonderful to have the digital collection that we can share online with people to give them some ideas about what we have in our collections. Our researcher application is also available on our website. And generally what I do is I can work with individuals and, if necessary, scan documents for them and email documents to them. And we also do a great amount of public programming. Margaret Walker has a Margaret Walker Writers Trail marker. And we had a wonderful program for the unveiling of that marker. And it's a wonderful addition to our campus, and it's because it's located right in front of our building on campus. We have had digital programming, such as we've done our Gibbs Green programming, and we will be working with the Richard Wright publication of an extended version of The Man Who Lived Underground. We'll be having an event associated with that. So we have a number of, we have a very active social media. We are available. You can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. So we are available on those forms of social media.
Thank you so much again for chatting with us today.
Thank you, Christina.
And thank you all for listening to this podcast episode of the American Writers Museum.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Nation of Writers podcast, part of the American Writers Museum podcast network. The series continues next month with a new episode airing March 31st. If you'd like to learn more about American writers and their impact on our history, our culture, and our daily lives, explore our virtual exhibit, American Voices, now available at nationofwriters.org. Again, that is nationofwriters.org. Once again, thank you for listening. And to all you writers out there, thank you for writing.